Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
So what would you say is humankind's greatest invention? Printing press, maybe? The vaccine? Maybe the computer?
Remote control.
Remote control. My son would say Cheetos, but Ed Glaser says it's the city, the dirty, smelly, overcrowded city. And he says New Yorkers are among the happiest people in America, which is news to most New Yorkers.
Find that hard to believe.
Economist Ed Glaser joins us now. He's a professor at Harvard, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of a new book, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Good morning, sir.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I'm so glad you're able to join us. You know, there's been a lot of buzz about your book and the cover story that you had in the Atlantic magazine talking about skyscrapers. And your basic premise in that magazine article was actually, it looked like it was based on a chapter out of your book, in that we should simply allow skyscrapers to go as tall as we want to and not keep them shorter. What's the idea there?
The idea is that cities are capable of doing absolutely amazing things because they magnify mankind's greatest asset, our ability to learn from the people around us. We come out of the womb with this great ability to sop up information. And the amazing thing about globalization and new technologies is that even though we can telecommute in from the Ozarks, we still decide to live in cities. And in fact, cities are becoming stronger because of these new technologies, because what they do is they increase the returns to being smart. And we get smart by being around other smart people. And that's how cities work. The reason why we need skyscrapers is they provide space in cities. They provide enough living room, enough working room to accommodate the demand for urban areas. And that's why I at least believe that we should unfetter buildings in cities and allow them to provide the space that people want.
Well, you talk in your book about the ways in which life is better for people when they're living in the cities, and some of them absolutely make sense. You talk about how people, workers in cities are more productive. They generally have a higher standard of living in terms of their pay. But one of the claims that you make is perhaps one of the most controversial in your book, which is that urban poverty, not a bad thing.
Absolutely. Cities don't make people poor. Cities attract poor people, and the fact that cities have for 2,500 years at least attracted large numbers of poor people reflects the strengths the cities have in terms of delivering things that people who start with less need. Most importantly, of course, economic opportunities. Cities have been ladders in which poor people can move up towards prosperity for thousands of years. They also provide ethnic neighborhoods. They provide social services. And in the U.S., of course, they provide the ability to get around without having one car for every adult. One of the pieces of research that I mentioned in the book shows that when you build new subway stops in an area, the poverty rate goes up near those subway stops. Does that mean that subways are making people poor? Of course not. What's happening is that subways are actually attracting people who want to be around public transportation, who don't want to have to live in a car. That's one of the many ways in which cities actually appeal to poorer people, and that's something to be celebrated about cities, not something that we should think is a big urban problem.
But Ed Glaser, what about all that epidemiologic data that I used to read? I think I read an article, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, in JAMA about 7, 8, maybe 9 years ago, saying controlling for all other factors, living in the city makes you live a shorter life. Controlling for socioeconomic, controlling for weight, employment, the city kills you sooner.
You know, this was true historically. So a child who was born in New York City in 1900, could expect to live 7 years less than the national average. Today, life expectancy in New York is about 2 years longer than the national average. And this transformation, this move from cities being places of death to being places of health is a remarkable thing. One major reason why that happened was that cities invested huge amounts of money in large pieces of urban infrastructure that created clean water in cities like the Croton Aqueduct. And this led to a radical reduction in the contagious diseases that are so common in cities. But of course, you're right. Density has downside. If I'm close enough to exchange an idea with you face to face, I'm also close enough to give you a disease. And that requires management, and it requires lots of interventions, both against crime and congestion. And that's one of the topics that I address in the book, is how were the tenements tamed? How were these problems that are so rife in urban areas taken care of?
Well, Dr. Ed Glaser, economics professor at Harvard, the book's called Triumph of the City. One of the things that's just very difficult for me to kind of swallow is your view of zoning regulations, because you feel like we should do away with a lot of them and relax those that are left. And one of your ideas is that if someone's building a building, let's say, for example, that someone is going to build a new building that's going to block the views out of the window of people in an apartment complex nearby, your thought is that instead of barring them from building that tall building, they should just make a one-time payment to the people who are losing their view and be done and go ahead with construction. And that's difficult for me. How is that not just like dumping some money down and then forever blocking people's view, which is actually part of their quality of life?
There's no repealing the laws of supply and demand. And if demand is high for an area and you don't build, then prices are going to soar. And too many of our cities have become unaffordable to middle-income Americans because we've restricted building in them. We need to figure out a way past this. We need to figure out a way so that ordinary people can also afford cities. Now, some places like Mayor Daley's Chicago have been quite good at allowing the cranes to deliver affordable housing on Lake Michigan. But other places, particularly in Europe, have tried to turn cities into essentially museums. Cities need to change. Cities need to grow. Cities need to deliver new space. And we need to figure out a system that balances the rights, the desires of existing residents to keep their neighborhood as it is, with the fact that there are new people, there are other people who are not there at this time who actually want to move in and who desperately need affordable housing. The idea of having a charge is a way of trying to get at that, so that, in fact, you pay people for the lost view. On average, I estimate that the value of, say, an apartment in New York drops by about 20% if a view is blocked. If it doesn't have a view relative to having a view. So it's not unreasonable. It's appropriate, I think, to think about charging builders for the social costs of their building. But you don't want to just say no. You just don't want to create a situation in which supply can't make a city more affordable and more inclusive.
Well, this is actually a discussion we could continue for the next 2 hours with Ed Glaser. He's an economics professor at Harvard, senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, author of the new book, Triumph of the City, How Our Greatest Invention Makes Us Richer, Smarter, Greener, Healthier, and Happier. Unfortunately, we don't have 2 hours, so Ed Glaser, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Bye-bye.
Well, as we've been reporting all morning, President Obama's fiscal 2012 budget came out yesterday to that hostile Republican reaction. The question is, if you were in control of the budget, what would you cut?
Let's start with cutting our congressional representatives' pay raise they just voted for themselves.
Now, I'm not sure, Sally, if that's true. I think Congress actually voted to freeze their pay, but we'll look into it. That was Sally from Tennessee. Here's Hector from New Jersey.
All subsidies to big oil should definitely be cut. They make way too much money, and they boast about it with their quarterly earnings. Additionally, I think that there needs to be a tighter control on foreign aid, in particular to Afghanistan and Pakistan. And I'm certain that goes into the hundreds of billions.
Well, tell us how you would fix the federal budget by calling us at 8778-MY-TAKE and go to thetakeaway.org to see the entire list of proposed cuts that Republicans have on the floor. Take our survey to see what you would like cut or see saved. I'm Todd Zwillick.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway. We're not getting cut.
Better not.